Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. This is an important announcement for anyone thinking about advertising here on Everyone Loves Guitar. We've experienced incredible growth. We currently have over 82,000 monthly listens, and I would anticipate cracking six figures in the next few months. We've also grown our YouTube subscriber base by 72 times. During this time, we've kept our advertising rates consistent, but I wanted to let you know we'll be increasing these rates after the first of the new year. So if you're a business looking to generate new leads or increase your cash flow by adding new clients or customers, or if you're looking for general brand exposure, or if you're a label looking to promote new music and you want to lock into the current advertising rates before they go up at the end of this year, then listen closely. Fill in the short form at everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Even if you want to advertise next year, contact us now and you'll get to lock into the current rates before they go up at the end of this year. Thanks for listening. See you soon. If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area in Hillsborough, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on the 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And I've got a really great rock and roll blues guitarist on, a guy I recently only got turned on to. And I'm so happy I did because he's really, really a great rocker, with Dudley Taft. And I want to give a quick shout out. Thanks to Dana Gordon for setting this up. And don't forget to, you can check it out now. We're on YouTube as well. So watch the videos, subscribe to our YouTube channel as well as a podcast. Quick background on Dudley, and then we'll get into it. First Dudley I've spoken to actually as well. Dudley Taft grew up in the American Midwest, went to Berkeley. His music career began in high school when he founded the band Space Antelope with his friend Trey Anastasio of Fish. In the 90s, he founded Seattle band Sweetwater, and they toured the States opening for Monster Magnet. Man, I had Ed Mundell on my show from Monster Magnet. Did you know?
Nice.
Yeah, did you know Ed back in the day?
If he's the original guy, then yeah. I mean, yeah. It's been 20-some years now.
Yeah, I think they had a guy, John something, I forget his last name, was there for a minute, but then it was Ed for most of the time. Also opening for Monster, besides Monster Magnet, Candlebox and Alice in Chains. Excuse me, after recording two albums for Atlantic, he left the band to join Second Coming. More touring followed with an album on Capitol Records and a taste of success thanks to the single Vintage Eyes, which made it to the top 10 on rock radio charts. In 2006, Dudley started playing blues rock in Seattle. He released the album called Left for Dead in 2011. His fourth album, Skin and Bones, came out in 2005, featuring Reese Winans on keyboards. And since 2011, the Dudley Taft Band has toured the United States and Europe, playing clubs, theaters, and festivals. In 2017, Dudley was nominated Best Guitarist by the European Blues Society. His latest release called Simple Life, it is a great record. We're going to talk about a couple of tracks today. It's his seventh record. It's had several chart positions in the Roots Music Report, including number 2 blues rock single, Give Me a Song. whose music has been featured in movies and on TV, most notably The Sixth Sense and On That Metal Show, Gene Simmons' Family Jewels, and many more. Dudley's currently living in Cincinnati. He just got back from a big tour in Europe. And, dude, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Craig. Good to see you, buddy.
Likewise, man. Anybody who doesn't know Dudley Taft's music, I'm just going to tell you flat out, I'm really encouraging you to check it out. He is a great musician, great songwriter, really good songwriter, great guitar riffs, and there's nothing you will not like about it. So quickly, you grew up in the Midwest, went to Berkeley in Boston, and then in the 90s, you moved to Seattle. I was curious what brought you out to Seattle. And, you know, if there's any other moves or whatever, feel free to fill in the gaps.
Oh, man. I've lived everywhere. You know, I grew up in Cincinnati until I was about 9. And my stepdad, he would start these retirement living facilities. So we spent 18 months in Philadelphia, 18 months in Houston. I lived in Indianapolis.
Oh, wow.
For a while, from like 79 to 86. But in 81, I went to boarding school in Connecticut. And then in 84, I went out to Los Angeles to go to college at Pitzer College, one of the Claremont colleges. And then in 1990, after spending a couple of years sort of rattling around LA after I graduated, you know, I moved to Seattle, and that was the best thing, you know, for me. It was really good timing. I got into a really good band, and, you know, there was no looking back at that point. That's when I realized, holy crap, I can do this for a living.
what was the appeal about Seattle? Why there?
Well, you know, I graduated in 88. So it was sort of the end of the, you know, LA hair metal scene. And, you know, I love playing, you know, rock and lead guitar and everything. And so I tried to get in some bands, and they just didn't like the way I looked, you know, because I never had great hair. And
me neither.
I just got discouraged, and LA was so big, and there was so much competition, and there was no real sense of community that I found. So a guy that I had been sharing a house with said, hey, you ought to come up to Seattle, because he had an apartment up there, but he was mostly spending his time with his girlfriend. So I just spent a week up there and tried out for a couple of bands and thought to myself, man, this is it. You know, it was much smaller city at that time, and certainly than it is now. And it was more manageable, you know, it was more like a Cincinnati or Philadelphia is even kind of bigger. In Indianapolis, you know, it was a manageable size city. You could drive downtown and park on the street and go to a club. And, you know, it wasn't hard to get around. So, and I, you know, had some friends there that I knew in college. And so I kind of had a foot in and just quickly made it my home.
That's cool, and, man.
Had a lot of fun.
Sweetwater was a cool band, man. You had a hit with Head Down. You're opening for some great bands, obviously, and you had two records on Atlantic. What happened? What wound up happening with that band?
Well, first of all, the beginning of it was super cool, I have to say, because, you know, these guys in Sweetwater had a guitar player before, but he wasn't playing with them anymore. And they would kind of come up with these very simple ideas, sometimes just four chords or something. And so I really enjoyed helping them write songs. Like, okay, we need a bridge, or we need, you know, maybe we ought to go to this chord to start the chorus, or, you know, and it made sense. And our third gig, we opened for Mookie Blaylock and Alice in Chains. And of course, Mookie became Pearl Jam. And after that gig, every gig we played in Seattle was sold out. It was incredible. We started touring and everything, but eventually we sold out the Paramount Theater, you know, like, I think it's like 3,200 seats or something like that. That was a lot of fun. But, you know, we had a tough time at on Atlantic. Stone Temple Pilots was signed about the same time, and they were putting all of their might in the promo and behind them. And they had that Plush song on MTV that kind of started taking off. And you know, they didn't really put much effort into promoting us or advertising for us. So that was a big, you know, air of discontentment and discouragement in the band. And they just thought, since they, you know, there was like four dudes plus me, and they were all from Seattle and grew up together, like, well, we need to get rid of this guy. And so you know, the writing was on the wall, and doing the second record. So I'm like, okay, I'm out. And I got lucky because they put out their second record and then got dropped immediately and had to start over.
Oh, wow.
And I was already starting to play with the guys from Second Coming. And so I kind of got that ball going. I mean, it really hurt at the time. It was it was a bummer because, you know, Sweetwater was my everything. You know, it paid my rent. You know, I had a lot of great times on the road, you know, 24-year-old cruising around in a van, and times were a lot different then. Rock was huge. You know, there was a lot of young people at the shows. You know, we were part of this cultural thing. So that was a little tough to recover from, but luckily I got into this band Second Coming, where I did pretty much all of the songwriting except for, you know, the lyrics and melodies and stuff. But, you know, that worked out really well. We got picked up by Gary Gersh over on Capitol Records. We are paid for our album. They gave us like a giant advance that we just put in the bank. And so we were feeling pretty fat for a while. And we did, you know, did some decent touring. But right when, so you talked about that song Vintage Eyes making it up the rock radio charts. So we were like going to rock radio for the grassroots following, and then they were going to release a single to alternative radio, which was really the pop rock radio at the time. And this guy from EMI North America came in and fired everybody, including Gary Gersh at Capitol Records, and they just shelved us and
holy shit.
Ended up giving us some money to just go away. And it was really terrible because Gary Gersh was making us a priority. And, you know, I think we could have gotten a lot further. But having said that,
the silver lining, here goes.
I am glad that it didn't work out, because then I would have had to deal with those motherfuckers the rest of my life. And I'm happy that I'm not, because there was a really bad apple in that band. And so now it's just me and whoever I want to play with me. So I like that a lot better. Even if I'm not, you know, touring around in a tour bus or anything, this is much more gratifying for me as an artist.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. What was the demise, or the combination of the rotten apple and the company kind of pushing them out, pushing Gary Gersh out? Was that sort of like the final straw that made you say, fuck it, I need to do my own thing?
Well, I mean, not immediately, you know. There was an effort to write another record for Second Coming. We got a little advance to do some demos. But then there was a falling out in the band, and there were two camps and a lot of legal wrangling, and it was just too much.
That's awful, at one man.
Point for me. So I decided, well, I'm going to start another band, another rock band. And so I got a bass player and a drummer, Joe Shaughnessy on bass. And I got that drummer who played with Heart for a long time, Ben Smith, was with me. But we never found a singer. And so it kind of splintered apart. And then I did this thing called Omnivoid, which was sort of a, you know, a rock band that was about like girls and cars and stuff. And that was a lot of fun. And then the singer from that band, I asked him to do this. Like, I was going to do like a ZZ Top tribute band just for fun, because I was just sick. of the whole rock scene. And this, you know, at this point, it was about 2005, 2006. And it wasn't like 1990 where there'd be two or three bands at a club and it would be packed. There were seven bands and the only people there were the other band members and their girlfriends. Yeah. It was really a sad scene. It wasn't, you know, that bad. But
and where was this? This was in Seattle?
Still? This was in Seattle.
Yeah, which I mean, at that time, I'm assuming you had a pretty good foothold there by that point in time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. People knew who I was, and I was also playing with this band called Spike and the Impalers, which was sort of a big glorified classic rock cover band that was started by the morning radio show, the big morning show, the Bob Rivers Show in Seattle. And so we would, you know, play 2,500 seat casinos, and I'd be doing the talk box solo on Rocky Mountain Way and playing a whole lot of Rosie.
Oh, that's cool. That's a great gig.
Fun, but I just, you know, I'm just not a cover band guy.
Yeah. Well, if you're writing songs, it's not, yeah.
If you're I'm a songwriter. I'm not, I don't, you know, it's fun for 5 minutes, you know. But that helped get the word out about me. So yeah, there were people who come to the shows, but it just wasn't as vital anymore in Seattle. It wasn't the same thing. So I thought, well, screw it. I want to do something fun. And I love ZZ Top and kind of the bluesy rock kind of dealio. And so I learned a bunch of ZZ Top songs. And right about then, 2006, you know, was when YouTube was starting to gain popularity and people were uploading a lot. And so, well, how did they end the song, you know, that faded out or whatever, had two guitar parts? How did they do that live? And so I'd watch the videos. And then they'd have the little suggestion box come up. And I was like, Freddie King, who's that guy? God, name sounds kind of familiar. And so I started watching Freddie King and his band. And I'm like, oh man.
My favorite King, man.
Right here. This is what I want to do. You know, this is what I want to do. I want to, you know, I want to play songs, but Freddie would direct the band with his head and his guitar neck and you know, do things, improvise, you know. And so I thought, well, let's do our homework. So we learned a bunch of the sort of blues canon, you know, Three Kings, Albert Collins, Johnny Winter, you know, and a smattering of sort of bluesy classic rock stuff. Maybe I'm a Leo.
Oh, by Deep Purple. Deep Purple, great, you know? Song, man.
What a great blues tune, you know?
Great song. Yeah. That's a great song, man.
So, you know, that captured my imagination. So I kind of did that for a while and then started slowly putting my original songs in the mix. And then the singer who was with me at the beginning said, no, I don't really want to do this. It wasn't his, you know, it wasn't really in his wheelhouse. So I started singing and so I just, okay, well, I guess I'm the front man now.
And your singing voice is great, dude.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you have a great, I'm not blowing smoke. You have a great voice. It fits your music perfectly. It's listenable, and sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just went on a
tangent. No, it's all good.
I think it was really funny. It's either in Give Me a Song or Simple Life, you have like a 5-syllable word in there that I've never heard in any song. Like, gosh, I'm trying to, and I made a
note. Well, there's a couple of tongue twisters in there. Like, made my decision to, what was it? When I made my way through the haze of the blaze, my life became with a clear decision to execute my decision of excision so very carefully.
yeah, but excision, that's not like a word in a rock. You know, there's like yeah, sure. SAT prep words that are in there, you know?
Well, I try to keep it simple, but that was sort of a rhyme within the line and then that rhyme at the end.
Oh, it totally fit. It totally fit. Yeah, it was really cool. Sorry, man. I didn't mean to derail.
No.
So you said, hey, I'm going to sing here.
Yeah. So I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to sing. And I immediately realized there are some things I could sing and some things I shouldn't sing. So, you know, it was a journey. You know, I recorded the first album. I started it in 2009. Left 4 Dead and finished it in 2010 and kind of released it by myself, and then found a German label that released it in 2011, and we added When the Levee Breaks, whatever, on there. So I was just kind of finding my way at that point and throwing some shit at the wall. And I still play several of the songs off the first record. So I think I was on to something. And, you know, just since then, I just kept working at it and sort of finding my voice within the idiom in a way. Hmm. Although at first I was like, well, God, do I have to write blues songs? I kind of hate the 1-4-5 thing, you know. Have you ever loved woman? I did it, but I did it as a minor blues because I just didn't want to do it as a major blues. I don't really want to do the same crap everybody else is doing. This is not your grandfather's blues.
Dude, it's not. It's really not.
I grew up listening to British Invasion, you know, and they had taken American blues and sort of put their own spin on it. And of course, when I was a kid listening to it at age, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14, I didn't know who the hell, you know, B.B. King was or Muddy Waters or, you know, I didn't know any of these guys. So to me, that was my basis, my foundation. And so as I got older, I looked back and looked under the hood, sort of what the Stones and, you know, Deep Purple and, you know, the Faces and, you know, what they were doing at that time. And so I kind of got motivated by that, but I'd also been in the Seattle scene. And so I tuned down a half step. Sometimes I dropped C sharp and try to make it a little heavier and make it sound a little bit more modern. Instantly, I wanted someone that could play a 5-string bass in the band. So I was kind of going for my own sort of spin on that. And I still am in a way. And, you know, it's funny, this last record, I talked to my publicist and I said, hey, I'm thinking about doing a double album and I'm going to call it Blues Rock. And I want one to be kind of more blues that I write and blues songs that I cover or re-engineer. And then the other one is just kind of my rock stuff where people go, it's bluesy, but it's not blues. And they both said, no, that's a complete waste. Don't do that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, man.
You're throwing these tracks away and it's like, well, fuck. All right. So I just did my own thing. And, you know, this latest record turned out to be really more rock than blues. So, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't really care. It's just me and it's what I do. And I think the blues audience gets me more than the rock audience gets me, because the typical thing is, oh, well, you know, the rockers say you sound, you know, kind of too blues or whatever. The blues guys are like, well, you're too rock. So that means I'm in the right spot, you know,
man, this record That's where is
I like, you know,
it's funny because I was thinking when we first started talking before we were recording, I was thinking it must be easy for you to get audiences to listen to you because it's so, your music is not, it's so wide, the appeal. It's, to me, it's blues rock. I mean, it rocks, you know. That's like, how do you not, there's a massive appeal for this kind of music, you know. It makes people get up and move, maybe pick up my guitar every track pretty much, you know. I mean, it's a good fucking, it's a great record, man. So whatever you're doing, man, I keep doing it. When you went to Berkeley, though, what did you study? You probably studied jazz.
Well, look, man, I went to Berkeley for a summer semester because I partied a little too much my freshman year in college.
Right on.
All right? My first semester, I got a C, 2 Ds, and an F.
Time to go.
I stopped going to class halfway through the semester. I was having a really good time. So, you know, I took guitar lessons. I took ear training. It was like a music history class. And I mean, I just hung out with a bunch of other guitar players. And that was, while it was cool, I'm really glad that I didn't, you know, make that my college, because I think what it would have done was replace sort of in my musician's brain, replace my sort of, basic urges, you know, my
curiosity, sort
of uninformed, you know, musical leanings with this very you know, theory-based, you know, this is how you do this, this is how you do this. I think it would have stomped out a lot of my creative urges, honestly.
Yeah.
And so I feel that it's good to be a little bit ignorant with music. Like I'll hear something in my head and it's like, oh man, I want to get that down. And it's a struggle to get it down sometimes, but I don't want to just go immediately, oh, well that's, you know, that's a 1-6-2-5, you know, where the fives and, you know, an altered chord or something. It's, I mean, I want to hear it and experience it and enjoy the discovery, you know, writing songs. And I love writing songs. In fact, right now I'm kind of sick of all the crap on the last record. I'm ready. I've been working on new stuff already. You know?
Already.
That's just how my brain works, you know? But yeah, so Berkeley was just, it was a real quick in and out dealio.
You have a good attitude about the shit that doesn't work. I like that. You know, like a couple of things that you said, well, I'm glad this didn't work because it's good to be able to find, you know.
Oh, sure, man. Yeah. You know, failure sometimes can be a really good thing. You know, you got to, you know, try to do everything you can in this life. And, you know, some stuff doesn't work and there's a reason.
Absolutely. It
doesn't work, or there's a reason that I shouldn't have tried that. You know, like I became a general contractor for 5 minutes after the end of Second Coming. And it's like, well, I can't do that anymore. I can't do music anymore. But then I fixed up a house and sold it and lost 30 grand and it just about killed me. And so I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, man? So I started working for IQ Beats and we did imaging music for radio and, you know, needle drop stuff. And
yeah.
That was much better. I was making money and I was doing music and I was a lot happier. So good. You live and you learn, you know?
Yeah, man. I have this saying, you can't connect the dots moving forward, you know?
That's right.
You right. Can't. And, but you look back and you're like, oh, this happened because, and as I've gotten older, I know for me, I've resisted losses less because I'm like, you know, because you get to a point where you're like, if it's not working organically, you know, there's only working hard and killing yourself are two different things.
Yeah.
You know, and you really, my experience, you got to work really hard, but you don't have to kill yourself every day. And if you're killing yourself every day, because I've done that shit, it never works.
Yeah.
You know, so I've sort of learned like, you know, it's
well,
not meant to be, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I've just kept on going and kept on going. Even when it seemed really desperate and it seemed like, you know, I'm beating my head against the wall, and I'm glad that I did that, you know? And after playing guitar for 40 years now, you know, it's like, I have a better perspective on it. So instead of beating my head against the wall figuratively, I know I'm working towards something.
Yeah.
And whether it turns out the way I want it to or not, it's still a valuable part of my growth and experience as a musician.
Yeah. That's how you got to look at it. What have been, first of all the credit in the world for doing your own thing and stepping out like that. That's not an easy, it takes a lot of courage, a lot of balls. So right on for you, man. What has the journey been like? Cause you have a nice catalog, man, 7 albums. That's a big catalog, you know, for one dude.
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
But it's great.
I mean, like I said, I'm a songwriter. I'm always working on songs. So that's, you know, coming up with new material is not the problem. It's with me mostly, it's because I have to wear all the hats, you know. It's like, okay, I recorded everything. Now I got to mix it, and I don't mix every day. So,
so you're doing the mixing and the mastering as well.
Oh, yeah. I didn't do the mastering, but I do the engineering and mixing. Sometimes I get help with engineering, but usually it's some dude that comes in, helps me get drum sounds and because that's usually the crazy first days when I've got a drummer in town and I've got him for 3 days and we need to record 12 tracks or something. So I'll get some help there. But the rest of it, you know, is me. And I've been using Pro Tools since it was audio media, you know, for a long time. And I know it really well. But it's, you know, me having go in there and do the editing and then, you know, do the overdubs. And it's good that I don't work with a producer because they would just hate me forever to record my guitar track sometimes. Like, you know, if I have a long solo, I'm going to work on that son of a bitch until it's fucking stellar.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not just going to blow a couple of takes and, you know, my usual shredding or whatever. I mean, I really try to make each, you know, because I'm, you know, basically born, bred lead guitar player.
Yeah.
That writes songs and sings. It's like I want every, you know, solo to be, to tell a story, to have an experience and sound different. So, you know, I just take a long time, you know, getting this shit done. But I keep my head down. I keep going. I'm working on the next one. And it's fun. It's what I do, man. You know?
Let's talk about the new record, because there are some great solos on there. What I like the most about the record, and it's called Simple Life for everybody listening, loads of like high energy stuff on there. Really good guitar, great soloing, great riffs, but not at the expense of the songs. And I wrote this before we talked. You're a great songwriter. That's what I really liked about it. It's good stuff, you know. But you know how it is with guitar players. Sometimes it's like, man, look at my big dick.
Yeah.
And it's like, but you know, you lose the song. And everything worked on this record really, really well.
Thank you.
Talk about Give Me a Song. I thought that was that's the opening track. What a powerful tune. It was like, you know, I wrote my notes here. Like, it's a great background song to pretty much pump you up and do anything. What was the backstory to that?
You know, that's interesting. This was this particular song was kind of an anomaly for me. And it goes back to this French guy that I met, Manu Lanvin, Lanvin. He's from Paris. I met him at a festival in Poland. And it was funny because I had never met him, and we were hanging out after the show. It was just like our two bands did 3 or 4 gigs together. And I said, hey, you know, I'm recently empty nest, and my wife and I are going to go spend, you know, 5 days in Paris. Do you know anything about Paris? Oh, yes, Paris. I live there. And then like he wanted to know where I was staying, which I thought was funny. And I told him, and it was a nice hotel, and I think something in his mind clicked. Oh, I know this place, you know, Place du Bourge. And he was very excited to, you know, whatever, help me get set up for our first visit to Paris. But we became fast friends, and I really like the way that he performs. So you know, I play my songs, and I've had a learning curve as a front man, because I was always sort of the, you know, Keith Richards or whatever in the band. And so I had to learn how to be a front man. And this guy is a consummate front man. And he's got a lot of these songs that are great live, okay? Like 4 on the Floor with a swing to it. And, you know, he'll pick up something in the blues canon and sort of make a variation on it and make it into his own song. So, I'm pretty sure he was vibing off of a Black Keys tune, and he wrote a song called Blues, Booze, and Rock and Roll. And I just love that beat, you know, and when they start the song, you can see the audience before they play a lick, you know, and the audience is like, you know, we love this beat. And I'm like, man, I need one of these, you know? So I thought, I kind of go through all my demos, and I'm like, this one right here might be kind of cool. So I sped it up, have my drummer do kind of the 4 on the Floor with the swinging, you know, tom-tom beat. And we just worked it out in the studio in, you know, a couple hours. But what was cool about that song was recording it, you know, the drummer and my bass player were just grinning from ear to ear. You know, it's like, even, you know, us as jaded as we are, you know, like recording 25 songs to make 10 on a record or whatever, you know, it's like, this one is really
great,
cool. And so, you know, it just worked out really well, I think. And, you know, I guess for me, it's maybe a little bit more pop or something with a woo-hoo-hoo, you know.
It rocks pretty hard, man. I wouldn't call it pop, like, but it's a good song, man.
Yeah, I know. But for me, you know.
Right.
So that just worked out really well. I got lucky.
It's a great song. Then you got a song on there called Pouring Down. It's like the 1, 2, 3, 4. It's the 10th song.
Yep.
The intro with the wah is, and in the wah later on is really good. What is that about? The rain is pouring down.
Oh, God. Oh, this song is kind of a dark, it's a sort of a dark riff off of, like, I was kind of trying to picture something David Bowie would write. You know, David Bowie's one of my favorite all-time songwriters, you know, David Bowie, Neil Young, Lou Reed, those guys. And I just, you know, I don't know, just putting myself, like, what would he write about? And kind of about a life that you stole, or feeling like an imposter when you're not very happy with yourself and you feel like your life is a sham, you know, and it's all going to come tumbling down, you know. And I know everybody feels that way at times, you know, depression. Sure. or a desperation or a futility, or, you know, even ennui, you know, just.
Man, sometimes shit just isn't working.
Yeah. And it was just a simple tune, but yeah. I like the way I use some different kinds of voicings when I write songs. Mm. I like sixths a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you look at this particular tune, it's I play the fifth on the bottom, and so, you know, the chords are basically C, B, E flat. Sorry, yeah, C, B flat, E flat, B flat. But I'm playing the low G and the low F on the C and B flat chords, which gives it sort of like a super heavy kind of tonality. Because if you play the fifth below the root, kind of your brain tries to hear the root further under that one. That makes any sense?
Yeah, and it's not there, so it's engaged.
I think that was the trick in that tune, is just to make the chorus sound just so heavy. And there was a song that we played. God, what was the band called? I want to say Hater, but it wasn't Hater.
Hater from Seattle. I remember them, man.
It was like, oh shit, I always forget the name of this band. Helmet, or anyway.
Helmet, I remember too. Yeah. I actually had Paige Hamilton from Helmet on the show.
One of these bands, and it reminded me of a song that we used to cover in Second Coming before we started the original stuff. So I don't know. I thought it was cool, but very, you know, very heavy, you know, more my Seattle grungy kind of dealio.
Great track, man. I love the wild, great guitar on there, man. And is one cover song on the record, Warren Haynes, If Heartaches Were Nickels, which is a great song. I don't know that he's ever done that, actually.
I don't think so. I don't think he has. I mean, I just heard the Leslie West, Joe Bonamassa.
Right. That's what I know.
On Bluesville way back. And Joe would play it live. Joe Bonamassa would play it in a set live for years, and he finally abandoned it. So I started playing it, and then I kind of rejiggered the middle part. But I just really enjoy playing that song. And if you do it right, it has all these ups and downs in it. And for a slow song, you know,
pretty song, man. Really,
in front of an audience, you know, it works. And I always tell them it's got a little Pink Floyd in there, because it's got Shine On You Crazy Diamond, Descending, you know, root 7, flat 7, major 6 against the 1 kind of thing. I love playing that song. So
hey, that half semester in Berkeley really worked. I know you were smoking weed and fucking around, but you're like on top of your theory shit.
Well, look, man, there's only so many notes. I know where the notes are. Right. That's not a big deal.
Right. You're modest. But you know your stuff though, man. That's good. It's a great, great song. Great cover of that too, man.
Thank you
do a really good job of not using the same tricks over and over again. For example, you got a wah, you got a female doing background vocals, different tones. Sometimes you have fills in the song, sometimes not. That's really good. Is that, how much of that is deliberate?
I'm not sure if deliberate is the right word, but I mean, when I'm writing a song, I really try to follow the muse of whatever, you know, that initial idea was and just take it all the way. So even if the song doesn't make any sense for me, or like, oh my God, you know, this could be a Chris Stapleton tune, or you know, I should try to find somebody in Nashville to send this to, or this is too metal or something. I just sort of follow it. And I think every song, you know, they're like my little babies and they've got their personalities. And you know, some of them just don't work, you know, yeah, or they're not appropriate for what I'm doing. It was funny. There was a song I wrote called Barrio, and it was on, maybe Screaming in the Wind or something. And it was a very different song for me. And it's funny because I heard it in my head and I kind of figured out the chords and I realized there is no way I would have written that chord progression. It's just because I heard it and I heard the song and I just sort of fleshed it out. And I went to, on another tour in Europe, and I ran into one of my Belgian buddies who's a big fan. And so I said, what do you think of the new album? And he's like, oh, that Barrio song, man, I do not like that song. You know, oh, wow. That was his way of saying, I love the album, except for that one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so we made fun of him and played a little bit of it that night. But, but yeah, every once in a while, it's just something totally weird. And I don't know, man, I don't have a regular bag of tricks to reach into. And sometimes in a way I wish I did, but I'm glad I don't, if that makes any sense. It would be easier to come up with new songs or something.
May not be as fresh though.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it's just the way I do things. I'm not sure I could do it any differently than that. So this last tour had a drummer from England named Darby Todd. And Darby plays with Martin.
That's a hell of an English name, man, isn't it?
Darby Todd, yeah. Yes. He's playing with Martin Barr's...
His band that he's got, yeah. I had Martin on the show, so I know exactly what you're
talking about. Jethro Tull, yeah. Jethro Tull's, you know, Martin Barr's Jethro Tull, whatever. And he's played with the Darkness, and he's played with a lot of other... you know, blues cats. And so his comment was, when we got our sets together, he said, you know, normally an hour set is about 7 songs. It's one of these other guys, you know, you play a verse and then you solo, and then there's another verse, you solo and solo and solo. And it's like, with you, we play 12 songs, you know, in an hour. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, we have certain songs where we stretch things out, and we have larger improv sections, but you know, for me, that's not that interesting for me. And I don't think, I don't know, maybe for all the, you know, guitar heroes in the audience, all the guitar freaks, they would prefer that. But yeah, I think entertainment value wise, you know, it's the song, present the song. And that's what I want to be known for. Not like, man, that guy could really, you know, play a mean solo for 8 minutes or something. You know, it's like, I want people to remember my songs and want to put my stuff on and listen to it, you know, after they see me.
Yeah.
A lot of bands are great live, but it's like, I'm not going to go, you know, type their name in on Spotify.
You know what? It's interesting you said that, because if you think about it, how many people, especially today, are going to listen to an 8-minute song?
Yeah.
It's not like Wish You Were Here, the days where you'd sit and like, you know,
listen to a side of an album.
Right. Yeah. You know, like I always listen to a full record because I want to have a relationship with that person. And I know listening to a song, maybe it'll work, but I want to see what that person's about. But it's, you know, most people are not devotees like that, you know, of music.
So yeah,
I think that's a smart idea. You want to, because I'll never forget, I had a guy named Cliff Goodwin on the show. He played for Joe Cocker in the for 12 years. He was his MD and guitar player in the heyday, like late 60s.
Mad Dog, Englishman, that era.
Yes. And
Alan White on drums.
I don't remember the name, but you know it better than me. Yeah. But Cliff said to me, he said, you know, Craig, no one ever won a Grammy for the snare drum.
Yeah.
You know, if the melody and the vocals don't put it together, man, that's what people hang on to. And he was so right, you know, and that's exactly what you're talking about. And I think it's as smart as an entertainer.
At the end of the day, the songs win, you know. Yeah,
totally, man.
And, you know, it's not like, oh, well, I realize that, and so I want to be a songwriter. It's just I've always fell in love with that.
Yeah, you're a great songwriter, you
know? Man. Grab an acoustic guitar and play, you know, some Lou Reed stuff, some Neil Young songs. I mean, it's just, you know, I love playing lead guitar, but if you give me an acoustic, I can play hours and hours of that stuff. And that really, you know, to me, that's fulfilling and it's entertaining. And, you know, hell, my mom's favorite song I ever played was Space Oddity by David Bowie. She'd call it Major Tom. Play Major Tom. Tom.
Yeah, that's what everybody's parents called it back in the day, right?
Yeah.
Major Tom. Did you play your Strat for the entire record or for most of it?
Oh, well, no. There was a good mixture of Les Paul, some of my Stratocasters, and my 335. I don't remember what I played on every single track, but I've got three Strats that are really in the zone right now. You know, my main one for a long time has been a Maple Neck Relic. Mm. It was a Mary Kay Relic, one of the first ones ever made. It was like $199 or something. And it's got a single piece swamp ash body and bird's eye maple neck on it. And the neck and the body really agree with each other.
Yeah.
And it's a great sounding Strat. And then I've got a couple with rosewood fretboards on them. One that I just got recently, last year in Nice, France, of all places, I found one of these like sort of, you know, super duper custom shop, you know, like with some guy's name on there, made the guitar and, you know, super relict dealio. And I was in the store and I'm kind of going, you know, we're in Nice, France, and who buys this shit? You know, the guy was like, dude, they come down from Monaco and just like nothing, 4 or 5 G's for a guitar is like nothing for him. But I played like four of those and one of them just sang to me. And so I took that last one on the road, to Europe for the last tour. And I've been playing it live. I have to put a humbucker in the neck position, you know, or a stacked, you know,
yeah,
humbucker. Cause I can't play live with single coils. Cause if I'm getting RF, at least I need to be able to go to the, you know, bridge pickup and not have any noise, but I kind of dialed it in and I've got a guy in, the Seattle area who shapes all my necks for me. And, we actually have a little template, you know, and so I can just send it out to him. He can shape it, and send it back. And
what do you have done to the necks usually?
I take the shoulders down. I like a little thinner neck.
Okay.
I can't play a big fat neck.
I can't either. I don't like that. Mm.
My first real Stratocaster was an 83 vintage reissue. And it had about the thinnest neck on there I've ever seen on any Strat. Now at that point I was 13. I had no idea that the necks were fatter on other guitars. I just thought that's how it came.
Yeah.
So I got another Strat at one point. I'm like, what the fuck is that? I can't play that, you know? And so I found this guy and it's like, dude, just take that wood off of there. And so that's kind of how I like
the
necks on my guitars. I do it on my Les Pauls. I do it on just about, you know, just about everything. So it takes me a while to get my guitars all dialed in, but I'm lucky enough to have, you know, like probably four really great Stratocasters. Oh, I don't have a huge arsenal, but I've got four great Stratocasters, two amazing Les Pauls. My 335 is just an amazing guitar.
Tell me about that 335.
It's a 95 dot neck reissue. It's red. I put Lindy Fralin pickups in there, but not super high output pickups. I used it all through Second Coming, so you can do metal really, or, you know, heavy metal sounding stuff on there. And then you can also get bluesy, and it cleans up really nice. And of course it's hollow body, and you don't have to be that loud. If you have the right tone, you can just get singing feedback on almost any note. You have to control it, mind you.
Yeah.
You know, it can be a beast, but you know, those are sort of my main guitars. And then I've got a smattering of other guitars that sort of, you know, they're one trick ponies.
What are you playing through primarily?
Oh, lately it's been mostly old Fenders. I've got a bunch of old 60s Fenders. I've got two 1966 Deluxes that are fantastic. I've got a couple of late 60s Vibralux amplifiers. I got an old Fender Bassman, and I gave it to my amp guy up here in Cincinnati, and we just couldn't make it sound good. I think the original kind of circuit board is like this cardboard thing. It was just done. And he said, well, let me just build you something. And he, you know, he's way into the old tube amps.
Yeah.
You know, won't touch anything with a printed circuit board. It's only old Fenders and Marshalls. And so he just put this thing together, and it's like a super basement. I used it the other night when I was playing here in Cincinnati, and I looked over at my bass player, and I'm just grinning from ear to ear because I'm doing the solo in a deep, deep blue, and it's, and any note that I play is just blooming into this feedback, and it's just, I'm just having a guitar-gasm.
Right on.
You know, man. So, but it's been the old Fenders. And, you know, I used to have like a Soldano SLO 100, and, you know, I've got a nice 74 Marshall JMP, but, you know, for me, the Fenders handle pedals in a way that I almost like no other amp really handles the input, sort of like whatever the input impedance is. There, you don't get that. I mean, I've got some nice amps. I've got a nice match list from 94, but it's, the response is so fast on it. It sounds kind of hard in comparison to the Fenders. So, I mean, I've just been using those mainly. And a really good ribbon mic, nice pre, and you're pretty much there.
You know? Yeah. I would say 75% of the guitarists I've spoken with have old Fenders. That's a large percentage, you know, at least 75% primarily. I mean, playing through there. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's like, you know, there's like all this market for vintage gear and old guitars and so forth. And it's like, I have no use for a fucking $15,000, whatever. From the 60s. You just fuck off. I mean, they make guitars better now, or as good as they ever did. They do not make tube amps like that anymore. I'm sorry. I've tried all the fucking, you know, car amps and all these fucking boutiques, Swart and all this crap. And you know, it's not crap. I mean, some of them. But
no, I dig but where you're coming from, though. Yeah.
There is no comparison, you know, and I got one of these new Fender Deluxes, and it's got the Alessandro caps and mods and all this, and you put them right next to the one from 66, and there is no comparison. It is night and day. You know, it's like listening to vinyl and then listening to a CD. It is, your jaw will drop, you know. Yeah,
that's cool.
So anyway, so that makes me happy. And why fuck around with anything substandard? You know, yeah. I hauled these old fuckers out on the road with me.
I was going to ask you that. So you're taking these overseas and everything?
Well, I shipped a Vibralux over to Europe and have my dude put in the different output transformer, whatever, for the 240 voltage, 250, whatever, and or 220, whatever the fuck it is over there. And I love it. But I need to have I need to have an amp that's not going to blow up. So I always take two. So over there, I have a Tone Hunter TNT, which is a master volume, kind of like a Plexi or something. And it just sounds amazing on its own. And the Fender does too, but you put them together, it's like, oh, holy shit. You know, and the Vibralux is louder than fuck. Yeah. So I used to put it directly behind the 212 cabinet that I'm using for the TNT. And, a lot of times you're looking from the audience and you can't see the Fender at all. I've had one guy go, I don't see a reverb knob, on that TNT head. And I'm like, well, okay, you're hearing both, buddy.
Yeah.
Best of both worlds. But you always got to have a spare because they, especially on the Fenders, GZ34 is one of those rectifier tubes blow on them. I don't know why.
So you take another amp with you, or do you just carry extra tubes? What do you do?
I carry an extra tube and extra fuses. And in fact, it blew on me in the last tour, and I just swapped it out. Boom. It was all good. So kind of got lucky. Yeah, this last tour, everything broke. On the last tour. This
really?
Is one of the tours where everything breaks,
And you had backups or?
Yes and no. Well, the worst thing that I did was I broke my fucking glasses, man.
Holy shit. Yeah, man. You got a
really nice pair of Persol glasses, progressive transition lenses, really expensive, but hey man, spend money on your eyes, your bed, and your clothing. Oh, yeah. And your good grips too. don't skimp on that shit.
Your tires.
I fucking stepped on it. And
on your glasses.
It.
Oh
yeah,
my God.
So luckily we were in Cologne or something, and I went and got these, which are okay, but whatever. And then, my delay pedal started making weird fucking noises. That broke. My bass player's wah pedal started making crazy noises. My bass player was playing and the strap holder just came out of the horn.
Oh my God.
Just like whoop, and then suddenly there's nothing to hold his bass on.
What did he do?
He stuck it back in and just kind of like angled it.
Yeah.
Until we were able to get some glue and a toothpick and fix that son of a bitch.
Holy shit.
The amp blew. Our van broke down on the Autobahn.
we were driving a brand new
Ford fucking Tourneo or whatever the fuck it's called. Tourneo. And, it just died. And luckily I was able to pull over. There was no shoulder on this part of the Autobahn, which is fucking dangerous. But behind us, I don't know, stroke of luck, was one of those big fucking orange trucks where they had the arrows pointing, get in this lane because they're going to close the lane.
Oh.
Just happened to be driving behind me. And they stopped immediately, called some road assistance. And dude, the Germans, I'll tell you, man, they got this shit wired. Within 3 hours, we had our van. We were towed to a Ford shop. They diagnosed it, said it's a fuel injector. There's no way we can fix it. The son of the lady that was the two people that ran the dealership drove me to the Stuttgart airport. I got a new van. We had loaded in. We were off to the gig. So we barely
That's
made
really
that.
Cool.
It was one of those. Yeah, it was one of those days where I had to drive like 6 hours and play a show. And so we got there and the crowd's there and we're unloading just like, start at 9. We got there like 8:10.
Holy crap.
But we made it, it was just one of those things. But, it's the tour where shit went wrong.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's good. That is pretty efficient though, man.
No, I'll tell you, man, if that had happened here in the U.S., no fucking way.
You'd be on the...
It would have been 3 hours before someone towed us off.
Absolutely. You'd be waiting 3 hours for a tow truck. Yep, yeah. Exactly. And then you'd look at the bill for $600 for towing a van or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to pay the bill for that fucker. That sucked. But and Hertz wouldn't pay me back.
Wait a minute. You serious?
Yeah. No, they said towing's not included.
Even though it was the car...
Yep.
Wow, that really is bad.
Yeah. Yeah. $250 it cost me. Damn it. Anyway, shit happened.
Yeah, man. Ain't that the truth? Did you come from like a musical family?
Yes and no. My parents got divorced when I was like 9. Mm-hmm. And so I really grew up with my mom and my stepdad. My dad plays Dixieland banjo and he also plays the piano. So, you know, he'll play a lot of sort of musical stuff from the turn of the century, you know, Hoagy Carmichael up through like Louis Armstrong, and that kind of stuff. And so I heard that a lot growing up. But my mom, my stepdad rarely listened to music. They did have a turntable. And right when we moved to Philadelphia and I was about 10, I had the first Beatles record. And Hard Day's Night or something. And I Love Her was the last song on side two. And it just something like spoke to me, you know, listening to that. And then, dude, we had it was like K-Tel's Get Up and Boogie.
K-Tel, I remember that.
It was a two album. Yeah, it was a two album dealio. It was orange. And it had shit like the theme from SWAT on there.
Oh, that was badass.
Shannon, Get Up and Boogie.
By
50 Chic. Ways to Leave Your Lover. Huh. You know, so that was super cool. But you know, my mom and my stepdad weren't really into music that much, although my mom realized that I kind of had an attraction to the guitar, and so she was very supportive of me and bought me my first acoustic in 79.
That's very cool.
And got me guitar lessons when we moved to Indianapolis. And so, you know, she was very supportive, you know, but I was just doing my own thing, you know, at that point. And I realized pretty early on, because, you know, I'd moved a lot and I had changed schools so many times. And one time I had to do it in the middle of the year, and then that's fucking tough for an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
You know? And, so
you're like new kid, meet the rest of the class.
And
you're
you know, and fuck. It's like, you know, this kid's name is Dudley. And of course everyone's going to know my name immediately. Cause number one, it's weird. Number two, I'm the new guy and I don't know anybody's name. In fact, I kind of have like name paralysis sometimes. Even if I see you somewhere and I know your name, I'm afraid to say it, you know, because I might fucking get it wrong, but or I'll mumble it a little bit. Hey, Tony, how you doing? You know, but, I realized pretty early on that, you know, being a guitar player was sort of my social currency and it was my identity. He's a guitar player guy. So I don't have to be a jock. I don't have to be a cool guy. I don't have to be, you know, some, you know, nerdy bookworm to get into any of these cliques or anything.
Acceptance is a lot of rapid. You get to go to the fucking speed pass line from acceptance when you're a guitar player.
It was the global entry.
Yeah.
For teenagers the early 80s.
It was, man. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Very cool. Did you, man, speaking of, what were some of the lower points maybe through life that you had to deal with and how'd you get through them?
Oh, shit.
You were like full steam ahead until I asked you that question.
Okay. You know, one of the real low points is when, you know, I left Sweetwater.
Yeah.
And it just like crushed me, you know, but I don't know. I kept, you know, reaching out and playing with other people until I kind of found something. And, you know, and then when Second Coming blew up and everything, that was super cool. And it was fun until it was sort of cut short, like I told you about the reshuffling of the record label. But at that point in 99, my youngest daughter was born. And Second Coming was falling apart. The really bad seed dude in Second Coming was suing me for like $300,000. He was blaming me for you know, the destruction of the band and everything, which was completely stupid. And I didn't have fucking $3,000, let alone 300 grand. So I had to go through all of that. And that was very stressful.
Very stressful.
And at the same time, my first wife was cheating on me
with other
dudes. And I had just figured this out. And so I've got a, you know, a big lawsuit against me.
A new baby.
A young infant. And I mean, dude, I was like Iggy Pop body fat at that point. You know,
oh
I was just so stressed out. And I've always been a runner and exercised a lot and everything. I think I weighed 149 pounds or something, you know, and 160 is about where I should be. But
wow.
So that was really difficult. But in 2003, I started going out with Michelle, who's now my wife, my second wife. And so things got really, really good after that. But, you know, look, Michelle and I had a lot of low points and a lot of struggles because, you know, I was basically gig economy guy, you know, and yeah, maybe I do a couple of songs for Lakeshore Records or I, you know, get a little hit on Sixth Sense or something, you know, with one of my songs. But, a lot of times it was, you know, what did I make this month? Well, I made $1,300. Fuck, that's not going to pay the bills. Luckily, you know, she was doing everything she could to make money. You know, she was a hairstylist when I met her. And then she got her certified medical assistant.
CNA? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, CMA. And then she got her real estate license in 2007, which, you know, if you know what happened.
Right. A minute before the recession hit.
Yeah. And you know, she did everything. He worked as a medical assistant, worked at Nordstrom. And you know, at one point we were like, we got to get out of Seattle. It's just getting too expensive and too crowded. So we moved to North Carolina, Chapel Hill area. And I thought, man, this is going to be great.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the Piedmont down there. It's fucking wonderful. I just love the countryside there. And we were just outside of Chapel Hill, but there was Research Triangle Park there. So, you know, you've got Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, and there's a lot of businesses sort of like there was in Seattle. And there was like, you know, IBM, Cisco, Lenovo, when they had like Quintiles and medical, you know, testing and all of this stuff. And our next door neighbor was an Indian guy who designed chips for IBM. And so I just thought, well, this is going to be easy, you know, but my wife and the two daughters that were living with us at the time just fucking hated it, man.
Really?
Oh, just hated. They liked it for about 6 months and then just fucking hated it and hated me.
The weather? What did they not like? The weather?
No, just it was the culture. It was the culture shock because they had never lived anywhere but in Seattle. And, you know, since I've lived everywhere all over the country, it wasn't that big of a deal for me. You know, I had been in the South and, you know.
So it's a little slower, obviously. And it's not a city like Seattle.
It's just, I don't know, man. It's socially, there's a different flavor and it was a little tougher to get established there.
Yes.
Although, you know, I was doing well with my band and everything, but the girls just freaking hated it. So they kind of had a mutiny. You know, we had like an intervention and they said, look, we're either going back to Seattle or we're going to move to Cincinnati. And I'm like, fuck Cincinnati. Well, we had been going back there to visit my dad and my brother here in Cincinnati. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, whatever, a 7-hour drive or something, or, you know, every once in a while we'd fly up there and hang out. And so when they all had that sit down with me, I'm like, well, I'm not moving back to Seattle because, you know, Seattle was really getting crowded at that point, and we just couldn't keep up. You know, our house doubled in value in 10 years, but
now you got to buy one.
Yeah. The cost of living, you know, just went through the roof too. Yeah. So it wasn't really sustainable. It was nice because, you know, suddenly I had a giant chunk of money to put down on a house.
Right.
So we were able to afford a nice house there. And then we bought a house here in Cincinnati. And you know, my daughters, when we were looking around in the Indian Hill neighborhood, which is where I grew up and the only place I would consider living, they were just like, oh, I like it here. You know, big houses and everybody's kind of far apart. The houses aren't that expensive. You're a little bit off the beaten path, but the schools are really nice. So fuck, we ended up here. You know, I said to my dad, well, hell froze over. So I
guess there you are, man.
We moved back, but.
And now you're an empty nester.
Now all the kids are out. You know, between the two of us, I have a stepson from my first marriage who's 31 and he's got a daughter. So it's sort of my granddaughter.
Sure.
We've got a 29-year-old in New York City who's a singer, and she's Ashley Charmay. She sings on my albums.
Oh, she's the background, the female background vocals. Yeah, mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah,
great
she voice, goes by man. Her middle name, Charmay. That's kind of her handle. And she's doing great, singing top line for EDM and that kind of stuff in New York City. And then we've got a 22-year-old who's in college in Fort Collins, Colorado. And then the youngest one is 20 and she's living here in Cincinnati. And she moved out 2 years ago. And that's when we had our big trip to Paris.
That's when you could do that stuff, man.
We saved up. You know, we were ready for it. And that's another story. But now we are empty nest and we're getting it. You know, I mean, I'm 53 right now. None of our kids are pregnant or incarcerated.
It's a good thing.
My wife and I don't have anything bad wrong with us. So we're just fucking going for it.
Good
everything
for you,
man. We can do, everything we can get, we're doing it now.
Awesome. Very cool. Mm-hmm. How's your daughter finding New York? Is that a weird transition for her? Or was it just slowing down of things in the South? Because it is a much slower pace.
Okay. Well, so this is Ashley, and she didn't move with us to.
Okay. She didn't move to the South.
She was already out and on her own living in outside of Portland in Beaverton, Oregon. And she was living with this guy who, you know, was a producer guy. But, you know, she kind of got her feet wet with like Logic and Reason and that sounds like philosophy. No, I'm talking about the programs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was unsure. I was like, oh, okay. Let's roll. Yeah. Let's roll with this. This is okay.
Well, that's another conversation. Logic and Reason.
I'm like, wow, man, I'm waiting for my daughter to get Logic or Reason.
Yeah. Well, don't hold your breath. So she had been doing, you know, session vocals and there's this thing called Fiverr.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you can, it's like a little, app or something. And if you need a guitar track or a vocal or something, you get $50 or $5, whatever the fuck for it. So she started doing that. And then, she decided that she wanted a change in her life. And she had a friend, that she had known in Portland that was living in Manhattan. And so she moved in with her in a rent control apartment.
So she got a rent control. That is like, that's like hitting the lottery, man.
Well, I tell you, it gets even better, well, or worse, depending. So they were renting this place from this dude who was a heroin addict, and he fucking died. And they, Ashley found his body. It was pretty terrible.
Oh, my God. That's heavy.
Yeah. So essentially, I think they got their eviction notice last month. Man. They have to be out, but they essentially paid no rent for like 9 months, and they're in Nolita right by Soho.
I know. I grew really up there, good, man. So I know exactly where that is. Yeah.
Really good location.
It's very good.
In building where Blondie lived and Martin Scorsese lived in this building.
Where they are, that area, like Crosby Street sort of is around there. I think that is one of the most expensive places in the city.
Yeah. David Bowie lived right around the corner from there.
Wow.
And I love downtown, you know, Manhattan to me, you know, Chelsea, Tribeca, Soho Village. That's all.
Yeah, it's great.
That's where I like to hang out. Anyway, yeah. So she's probably going to move to Brooklyn.
Okay.
Pretty soon. But, you know, for her.
Good experience.
Yeah, it was a great experience. Yeah. And she's just starting to hit her stride now. You know, writing songs with producers like Con Rank, and I can't remember the names of the other ones, but you know, she's going to, they're flying her into festivals like all over the country. And just on her, you know, her Instagram story the other day, it's like her and like thousands of people out there, and she's rocking the mic. And
that's, you know, nice, like, man.
Yeah, super cool. So, you know, she's still, look, man, she still hits us up for a few $100, you know.
And if she's, if they're on their own and not, you know, and functioning, it's great, man. You know, to get people up and running, man. Yeah,
I feel that. Yeah, so we're lucky. All the girls are doing pretty well at this point. So.
Very cool, man. It's good to hear that. Switch back to music for a minute. You ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back?
No, I sell very few guitars. There's a couple that were just pieces of shit that I got rid of. There's one that I gave away to a music school, but no.
Okay.
I don't sell shit. I really don't. I just have a pile of stuff, you know, but I also don't buy any crap either. You know, I don't buy a lot of guitars. Although, you know, the past year, maybe I've bought more than I normally have. You know, I bought a Dean V, which
You're
is
kidding me.
Fun.
That is fun.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. And
they're down here. Dean is in Tampa here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Did you buy the Christian Martucci, Dean?
No, okay. No. It's got like a Sunburst V. I don't know why. I just they're cool. They're fun. Although to me, a V is kind of a toy. You know.
In what way?
I don't mean to offend anybody that loves Vs, but they're just, it's kind of a toy. But it's fun. And then I bought that green guitar last year. I found a really nice acoustic made by a company called Weber out of Canada. And I think the dude makes maybe 20 or 30 guitars a year. And it sounds as good as some of my Martins. And I just like, fuck it, and shipped it to Europe. And so I got a little like, I'm almost, except for having an apartment over there, I've got all my shit over there.
In storage. You know?
Yeah, I just take two pedals and a guitar over there, and I've got, you know, Les Paul, and I've got bass amp and, you know, drum kit and, you know, monitors. And I've got all my merch and vinyl and, you know, the whole nine over there, and acoustic, and got clothes over there, pants, stage pants, you know. See, so I go so often, it's like, fuck, I don't want to drag this shit all over the continent. Just leave it here, you know.
That's really good. That you got that, that many gigs booked over there. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not that they're that many. I mean, I'm working my way up the totem pole over there, and it's a slog, but I love it. You know, it's some of my most rewarding weeks of the year are when I'm over there playing. You know, I like playing in the US. It's cool, but there's a big difference over there.
Oh, sure.
And you get to explore Europe as you never would be able to, you know, just as a regular tourist. You know, I've met people, gone to places I never would have seen.
Because of the connections.
Because of connections. And I've got, you know, amazing friends in the Netherlands, Germany, and Poland, and France. And, you know, my 50th birthday party, we rented a VRBO on Lake Como.
Oh, in Italy.
Italy. So I had three daughters with me. My dad and my stepmom came out. My two Dutch friends, Anko and Helga, came out. three of my German family friends came out, Ralph, Christine, and Tarika. And so kind of had an international.
It's cool, man, for your party, birthday. For your birthday.
Yeah. That's great, man. It was super cool. And, you know, this last tour, I was in Poland, and I'm playing this festival, and there's guys like Anthony Gomes and Ron Bumblefoot.
Bumblefoot. Dude, I had both those dudes on the show. Ron is a super, one of the most creative people I've ever met in my life.
Oh, man, that guy's a force, isn't he?
He's really.
he's amazing. And whatever, we're having this press conference, right? And to promote this festival we're doing. And we're at this hotel and they've got all these chairs set up and there's about 30 Polish people like watching the press conference. And I realized I know more than half of their names at this point.
That's cool.
You know, it's like you kind of get these little communities everywhere you go. And that to me is as rewarding as the music and playing the shows and everything. So
very cool.
So, man, I love it. It's like going back to Seattle and playing. You sure. know, I see all my friends there and, you know, people that had watched me, you know, from all of my different bands through what I'm doing now. And it really makes life rich, you know. I don't need to be like headlining festivals all over the planet, although that would be nice.
Sure.
But there's more of a connection you make when you're playing, you know, bars and club gigs and small theaters, you know, on these kinds of tours.
But it sounds like you're able to enjoy the journey wherever you're at, because if you are headlining festivals, you'll just be enjoying headlining the festival with the same stuff, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I've done a little bit of that and it's been fun, but it, you know, I don't know, it's kind of cool if you like do a couple of gigs with another band and you get to know them and then you see them again down the road and,
sure.
you know, you keep in touch and look, this French band, Monu Lanvin and the Devil Blues. So, I needed to do some, I had like 4 days off in a row and we were, somewhere in southern Germany. I'm like, well, let's hit up the bass player. He's got a studio outside of Paris. And so we went down there for 4 days and recorded with Nicholas and, you know, did some demos and it's just, you know, just super fun, you know, kind of getting our little community of blues rockers in Europe, together. And, you know, Manu's coming to, he's going to be in New York City, this weekend. So I'm going to go out there and hang out and
very cool. Where's he playing?
He's not playing. He's doing some meeting for some international blues foundation or something. And I don't know. I'm going to try to weasel my way into that.
Yeah, man.
But you know,
where are you staying? Do you know?
Probably Soho Grand.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, man, give me your top three Desert Island discs. No particular order, and just for right now.
Van Halen 2. That record. Oh my God. Deep Purple Machine Head.
Yeah, that's great.
Bob Dylan Blood on the Tracks, maybe. But I could go on. I mean, you know, Ziggy Stardust and Spiders from Mars. There's a Lou Reed album called Best of Lou Reed, Walk on the Wild Side. That's one of my all-time favorite records. Harvest by Neil Young.
Harvest, great record.
Man. You know, Royal Scam by Steely Dan.
Great record. That comes up a lot.
I just love that record. Great, I mean, I love record. Steely Dan.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyway, I could go on.
Tell me the most important things you've learned about yourself, Dudley.
Most important things? Well, I've learned that I'm patient and you know, my dad said something once. He said, you know, something about this certain situation or whatever, not being worth the emotional capital. And I kind of thought, well, that's an interesting way of putting that, you know? So I've learned that I don't let myself get upset about things I can't control.
Man, that is so important.
So I'm pretty good at letting shit roll off my back. And you know, I guess maybe I've learned that I have a good defense mechanism for that kind of shit. And I just keep my head down and keep going with what it is that I want to do. Even when the pursuit seemed hopeless or futile, I just keep going. And, I think I've realized that's been something that's been good. I've always thought of it as a fault, you know, and I always thought,
well, fault?
Yeah. Why? I always thought, well, I'm wasting my time, you know, or learning how to play guitar. I don't want to fucking you know, I took lessons and stuff, and I know where the notes are and the chords are. I don't want to fucking read music or learn how to do this or, you know, sit down and practice, you know, playing, you know, two notes per string as fast as I can or whatever. It's like, I'm just not good at that. You know what I'm good at? I'm good at, well, as guitar playing goes, I'm good. I smoke a little weed and I just sort of like, you know, my brain just kind of opens up and I just play whatever is running through my scrambled egg brain at the moment. And I just keep going with that stuff. But what I realized is over the long run, instead of, you know, learning a very public domain vocabulary as a guitar player, I've developed my own vocabulary and my own way of doing things. And, you know, I think that's been a strength. Whereas before I thought it was, you know, I thought it was because I wasn't able to learn right. Or, you know, I'm so ADHD. I can never be like a shred guitar player, like a Satriani or a Steve Vai or something. And now I realize I'm glad that I'm not, you know.
Yeah. You don't have to be.
I like the way that I play. You know, I get these backhanded compliments a lot. And one of them occurs a couple of times, you know, when people review the album, they'll go like, oh yeah, song number three, man, great slide guitar playing in that song. Well, I didn't play slide on that. It's just because I bend the strings the way I bend the strings, you know? So people think I'm playing slide. I'm like, well, fuck, that's cool.
That is cool, actually, yeah.
I win. I feel like I win in that regard, you know? It's like...
Yeah, you're like a very competent guitarist, man. I mean, like I said to you, it's really nice to watch your old videos and listen and see how much you have progressed. Not that you were a bad player then, but your playing has evolved. You know, you could hear it. You're matured as a player. It sounds great. You know, sure, man.
I just keep going. You know, it's like I still play guitar at least an hour every day, sometimes more. You know,
for
just,
you, man.
Always, you know, I finish a tour or show and it's like, I don't put it down for a week. You know, I just keep going. Well, cause I like to keep smoking pot too. And it's like Pavlov and the dogs, you know?
Oh, you do the one, you got to do the other. Yeah.
I kind of did. I started smoking pot and playing guitar at the same time.
Is weed legal in Ohio there?
No.
Oh, it's not? That's weird.
No. Arrest me. Go ahead.
Oh, no. No one's going to give a shit about that. I was just curious if it was legal. No, I wasn't asking you, like, are you legal to be smoking it? No, I was just curious, like, is weed legal there? Because, like, it's I think it's legal here for medicinal purposes.
Yeah, and they've legalized it for medicinal purposes here in Ohio as well. But I do want to point out that I did stop smoking weed for 17 years. From age 27 till I was about, you know, 44 or 45.
Wow, that's a long time.
It was a long time. You know, it was interesting because I was smoking too much then. You know, I was getting high all day and not remembering anything and not getting shit done and being a dumbass, you know. So I quit and it took me a little while to sort of get motivated to play guitar again, because like I said, it went hand in hand. And
yeah, sure.
Fuck, for at least a year, I'd have dreams about doing a bong hit or smoking a joint or something. Sure. And then, you know, I kind of came through it. And then when I was in my 40s and I would catch one of my daughters with weed.
Yeah.
Now I'd usually throw it out. But one time I was like, God damn, that smells good. It's like candy. And I put it in this little wood box, you know, in my basement. And then I don't know why I did. It's like, I know in the back of my mind, it's like, I want to see if I can resist or something. And so I thought about it for weeks, man. I thought about it for weeks. And then one day, everybody was out of the house and I had my opportunity.
So this is like a little kid, dude, like when your parents leave.
I know. This is ridiculous.
Mom and dad were out for the weekend.
I went to a head shop, you know, in Seattle on Broadway. And I made very careful that no one saw me go in there or come out. You know, I don't want to be stupid, paranoid. So I got a little tiny bong and I brought it home and I put that weed in there, and I got high for the first time in, you know, 17, 18 years. And a couple of really interesting things happened to me. So first of all, oh, it was amazing. You know, you know, when you like look across the room and those guitars look really far away, yet really close. One of those things. But
you must have got totally fucked up though, first time in 18 years.
Well, I didn't smoke very much, you know. So and I still don't now that I hit it again. I have literally like I'm a professor, you know, this one, two, and I'm dude, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't do eight bong hits or smoke a whole joint or
anything. I don't even know how people that's possible. Like I would
especially so strong these days. But this little voice popped up in my head and said, well, you've been doing okay for the past 18 years, but we've got a lot of work to do.
Oh my God, that's hilarious, so, man.
Yeah.
So it was like your weed muse.
Yeah. And, you know,
we got a lot of work to do, Dudley.
It was funny. And then I thought, well, this is wrong. This is bad. And I'm writing music now, being stoned. But I read, Neil Young's autobiography, Waging Heavy Peace. And he admits in there that he wrote everything stoned. And in fact, when he had his brain aneurysm and he had to stop smoking pot, he didn't write any music until he hooked up with The Promise of the Real and Lucas Nelson and you know, part of the Willie, you know, Willie Nelson family. And so I think there was weed everywhere and he started smoking again. And that's when he started writing songs again. And I just thought, well, that's fucking interesting. You know, it's like one of my heroes baked every time he wrote a song. So, so I thought, okay. And that's kind of what I do to write music. You know, I get my shit done during the day, you know, about 4:30, 4:20, whatever. I'll have a little
at 4:20.
Seriously, man, I'll have a little hit. And then I get my phone, my iPhone is there. So I, you know, start working on some riffs or something comes in. I just do the voice memo, grab it real quick, move on, you know. And then, you know, after the initial rush of about 30 minutes to an hour, then I kind of mellow out. And then it's usually when I practice or I sing or work on whatever I'm working on. But I've got all these voice memos, all the shit that I go back to when it's time to make demos for the next album, and I'll just listen back and go, oh, that's crap, that's oh, that's kind of cool, you know, grab a drum beat, flesh it out, oh, that's cool, let's do this one. And that's kind of how I work.
So you do all the creative stuff comes when you're buzzed, and then you put it all out and then you deal with it later.
Yeah, I mean the initial idea does, and it's like, you know, I work on, I'm not, you know, stoned all the time. I'm working on stuff because but you know, if I have an idea and then I get everybody in the studio and it's 11 a.m. and you know, everybody's sober, but we flesh out the song and we kind of, you know, try to follow the muse or the personality of each song.
Yeah,
that's easier. But coming up with the initial idea, you know, usually that's, for me, that's a good way. And then same thing with the lyrics too. I'll just, you know, put that mic up right there. And I don't know if you can see, I got a little workstation right here. So I just sit here, you know, my shit, put my headphones on, kaboom, just start spitballing ideas, open my mouth. And you know, like Keith Richards said, you just go up to the mic and something comes out and, you know, and then you kind of figure out, you know, somewhere to start with the lyrics on a song. Let me pick up on the vibe of something.
Man, I tell you what though, it sounds like you're pretty regimented with, I mean, you're doing something every day, and I don't think it's possible to create as much as you've done, you know, seven albums, a big catalog. God knows how many songs didn't make the cut.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a large pile of discarded tunes, but you know, I don't know, man, it's like, regimented. I'm motivated and I work every day, you know.
That's discipline.
I study shit, dude. I'm also a pilot.
Are you really?
I like to perfect shit. Yeah, I just got my commercial ticket.
Good for you. Recently. Congratulations.
I got my single engine, IFR, multi-engine. you know, I like to learn and grow and study and achieve shit, you know.
You read a lot too, right?
I don't like sitting down and not doing anything. I mean, if I need to take a nap or something because I'm trying to get readjusted coming back from Europe or something, you know, I'll sit down and read a flying magazine or something, or, you know, I follow financial news a lot too. So I just read some of that shit, fall asleep, but I can't not do anything productive. You know, like on the airplane on the way back here, I fucking, you know, wrote the skeleton for the tour blog that we're going to post in a week or so here, on the last tour, or I'll work on lyrics or something. But I always have to do something every day. Otherwise I don't feel, I feel like I'm wasting my time.
I feel you, man. Yeah. No, being productive is a good feeling, man.
Yeah.
It's a real good
feeling. I mean, and you listen to a lot of people tell their stories, like Elton John. He was like, well, you know, get up and fuck, go try to work on some more tunes, you know, and even if you don't feel like it, but yet you still come up with stuff, you know, but I love it. I love the process, and I've been, you know, through the peaks and valleys enough now that I know it's just worthwhile, no matter what happens. This is what I do. This is what makes me happy. And I don't want to look back and go, man, I wish that I had put more energy into that or more time into that. And fuck that. I'm doing it now. Do it.
Three questions, man. And I really appreciate your time. Do you have any interests outside of music or hobbies?
Well, flying.
Yeah, that's really cool.
The flying thing is a lot of fun. I also somehow, I don't know why, but economics.
Yeah,
how money works around the world. I know more about, you know, the European Central Bank than most Europeans I know. I study financial systems. I don't understand why it's interesting to me, but it just is.
That's cool.
So that's one of my hobbies. You know, I just read about it. I have a little bit of money to throw around investing, and I'm not a trader by any means, but that's interesting to me. So, you know, and traveling, you know, I love traveling, whether it's for music or not, you know. What's
your favorite place you travel?
Well, I mean, at the moment it's sort of discovering Europe. I would like to travel more to Southeast Asia. I went to Indonesia on a scuba diving trip with my wife and some friends, and that was amazing. Went to Singapore. I've been to Fiji and Tahiti a lot.
Man, that's supposed to be beautiful.
I love the South Pacific out there. It's amazing. I really want to go to Palau and Chuuk and Yap. And I do want to see Japan, you know, and I'd like to go to Korea at some point, but I still have a lot to discover in Europe. You know, Vienna, I've never been to, it's on my list. And, you know, Italy, I haven't really been to Italy much other than Lake Como. So, I don't know, that kind of stuff gets me excited.
Yeah, man.
So
anything you wish you did differently, Dudley, or anything you regret not doing?
This sounds terrible, but I probably shouldn't have gone to college.
No,
I probably should have just found a band and just started playing with the band. But having said that, college was an important experience for me socially and, you know, as a person. I got a degree in sociology and a minor in philosophy, and that doesn't really, you know, that.
You could be an English teacher.
You get me a coffee at Starbucks, you know.
It doesn't
do much for you, but I think I maybe should have tried to, you know, be a guitar player in a band on tour when I was a little bit younger. But other than that, no, I mean, I think it's all been good. I mean, I was lucky to be in Seattle when I was, and part of the whole grunge music explosion, for lack of a better term. That was fantastic. I love the fact that I've lived all over the country. I have friends all over the place. I love my traveling to Europe. Love my family right now. Love my wifey and everything's great, man. I mean, I don't know that I would change a whole lot.
Very cool. And last question. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional and how much is just a kind of a natural part of aging?
I think the natural part of aging is wisdom and confidence. And I think I'm much more confident now than I was when I was younger. And I feel like I'm in control now. And there's a little blurb in my new album, and it's like, you know, all the little tiny decisions that I've made over my life have led to a really good quality of life right now. So, you know, I mean, that's
it. Awesome.
You know, I think you just refine who you are and what you do. And luckily I've had enough success at it to keep me interested and keep me going. You know, I'm not a huge artist by any means, but I enjoy what I do. And at the end of the day, that's all that matters.
Hell yeah. You know,
having a good vocation, and then also having, you know, good friends and good relationship with your family. There's nothing better than that, man.
I agree. And I also enjoy what you do, and I want everybody else to check out your music. It's Dudley Taft. The new record is Simple Life. He's got a really good, very robust website at dudleytaft.com. You also have the this in vinyl. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. People started requesting vinyl at my shows, and I'm like, well, it's just like two or three guys every tour. But I'm seeing the writing on the wall, you know, and I was in Nashville a couple of years ago, and I took a tour of the United Record Pressing plant, and they were talking about, you know, sort of demand and how they couldn't buy enough machines, and it was becoming like a thing. So I thought, well, what the fuck, I'm gonna try it this time. And so for Simple Life, I had my mastering engineer do a separate mastering for vinyl, and his guru dude cuts the plate or whatever and then sends it to the guys up in Cleveland that make the records. Got a groove, and you know, I guess got the highest quality thing everywhere, you know, along the line. And I've you know, actually sold quite a bit of vinyl. And apparently vinyl outsold CDs last year.
I saw that recently.
Yeah, so I mean, you kind of have to have it, you know, because I really need the merchandise sales cover the expenses.
Absolutely.
We had one show in Poland, and the last tour we sold $1,775 worth of merch, for me is a lot for, you know,
for one show,
like 300 seat theaters, you know, it's like, you know, that's the way to go now. And people really like the big physical product, and nobody's really got CD players.
No,
very few people have them. They're not in new cars anymore. So I think, from now on, I will always make vinyl. I'll always have to make CDs for, you know, radio shows and stuff, but maybe I don't need to do the whole 12-page booklet. Maybe I do
shows won't take a download?
A lot of them do not.
No. Oh my God, that is archaic. That's
very bizarre. It's blues audience, man. You know, it's on the very tail end of
adaption. Yeah.
So, yep.
That's interesting, still need, man.
CDs at this point.
Well, it's funny.
I had to order 2,000 of the new ones, man. I sent out like 800 freaking CDs for promos, and I sent a couple hundred to Europe and realized, holy shit, I don't have any.
Wow.
So, you know, and it's, you gotta order 1,000, otherwise you're paying too much per CD.
Yeah.
Well, I'll sell them.
Can everybody get your merch and the record on vinyl on your website?
Yes.
Okay.
You can.
All right. So a couple of things. DudleyTaft.com. Support Dudley's music. The new album, Simple Life, is great. He is headed back out to Europe in March. If you're listening to this and you're not watching, and he's got a great studio at home and he does tracks, he's available for sessions. So if you want to reach out to him, best way to do that is through social media channels, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And, man, I'm really glad I got turned on to your music, and I'm going to continue listening to it and supporting it. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Is there anything else that I forgot, or any final words of wisdom?
Just follow me on Instagram and, you know, reach out and let me know if you you know, how you discovered me or whatever and what you think. I like talking to my fans, and come to a show if you're in the Cincinnati area on the 26th of this month, October. I'm having a CD release party in Walfredo Reyes Jr.
The percussionist.
So he's he played on this record, played about 7 tracks on the latest record, and of course he plays with Chicago now.
Yeah.
And played with, you know, Steve Winwood and David Lindley and Carlos Santana. And, so he's going to play at the record release party.
Is he a local dude there?
What's that?
Is he a local guy?
Yeah, he's.
Oh, that's wild.
Yep, he's got a place now with a girl he met from Cincinnati.
That's wild. Very cool, man.
Oh, he's in town. It's kind of fun. So
that is awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah, we're having fun around here.
Dudley, thank you for everything, man. I really appreciate your time. You're a cool dude, man. Really good talking to you. And I will definitely support your music, and I'm really glad that I got turned on to you. Great player, man, and you're a great writer. So thank you. I appreciate everything.
Thank you, sir.
Hang on. Absolutely, man. Hang on one sec. We'll wrap up. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels with your friends. We appreciate your support. Check out Dudley Taft and all his catalog, especially the new record, Simple Life. It's a great record. Go to his website, dudleytaft.com. He's also available for track sessions. He'll be in Europe in March. He's just a great record, man. Just check him out. It's really good. If you like guitar, if you like rock, if you like to move, you'll like this music. You'll love it. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Dudley, thanks for everything, bro.
Later.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.